This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. JNSPG staff will read synopses of articles which have been published online this week. The full text versions of these articles can be found in the online and print versions of the journal.
Hello and welcome to the Journal of Neurosurgery podcast. I'm Debbie Francis.
And I'm Natalie Pinchem.
We will be reading synopses of two clinical articles, two case reports, and a technical note, all of which were published online today by the Journal of Neurosurgery. This clinical article is entitled Prevalence and Impact of Diffuse Axonal Injury in Patients with Moderate and Severe Head Injury, a cohort study of early MR imaging findings and one-year outcome. It was written by Torrell Skansen and colleagues. In head injury, brain damage may evolve from different types of primary injury. Diffuse axonal injury denotes diffuse pathological processes in the white matter that occur when the head is exposed to angular or rotational acceleration-deceleration forces. This injury can only be demonstrated with MR imaging, and thus the interest in axonal injury and head trauma has increased as MR imaging has become more commonly used. This study is a prospective study of early MR imaging findings with emphasis on diffuse axonal injury and outcome. The study population comprises a Norwegian neurosurgical cohort of patients with moderate to severe head injury who survived the acute phase. MR imaging was performed within 4 weeks in 106 patients, and patient outcome was assessed at 12 months after injury. The authors used a clinical approach with visual inspection of MR images, and diffuse axonal injury was classified into three stages. Stage 1 represents a pattern of traumatic lesions confined to lobar white matter, whereas in stages 2 and 3, lesions are depicted in the corpus callosum and the brainstem. The authors found diffuse axonal injury in 9 of 10 patients suffering a severe injury and also in more than half of the patients with moderate injuries. Very often, diffuse axonal injury was found in combination with contusions or hematomas. The Glasgow Coma Scale score was lower in patients with diffuse axonal injury. Moreover, only in patients with diffuse axonal injury was there a relation between the low GCS score and a worse outcome. Diffuse axonal injury was a negative prognostic factor when it was located in the brain stem, but otherwise, the patients with diffuse axonal injury did not have a worse outcome than patients with only contusions or hematomas.
This clinical article is titled The Impact of Therapeutic Modality on Outcomes Following Repair of Ruptured Intracranial Aneurysms, an Administrative Data Analysis. It was written by Kian J. O'Kelly and Associates. In a selected population of patients with ruptured intracranial aneurysms, the International Subarachnoid Aneurysm Trial, or ISAT, found a significant advantage for endovascular versus surgical repair after 12 months of follow-up. The durability of these results and their generalizability to all ruptured aneurysms has been the source of significant debate. In this study, the authors examined endovascular coiling and surgical clipping of ruptured intracranial aneurysms in 3,120 patients. Mortality, readmission for subarachnoid hemorrhage, and morbidity surrogates were compared between the groups. The mean follow-up was 4.5 years. Clipping had an increased hemorrhage-free survival over coiling. This result was robust after adjusting for confounders that were measurable from the administrative data. A sensitivity analysis was conducted to determine if an unmeasured confounder could have biased the results. This analysis suggested that although a strong negative confounder could remove the benefit seen for clipping, it could not revert the results to replicate the ISAT. Unlike the ISAT, this study demonstrated that clipping was superior to coiling. Given the limitations of this form of research, these results must be interpreted with caution. Nevertheless, the generalizability of ISAT to all patients with intracranial aneurysms may not be appropriate. Further study is required.
This case report entitled Microvascular Decompression of the Optic Chiasm. It was written by Nancy McLaughlin and Mikhail Bojanowski. Elongation of the anterior cerebral artery, or ACA, and subsequent compression of the chiasm rarely have been reported as a cause of visual field deficits. Neither has microvascular decompression of the chiasm been described in this circumstance. The authors report a case of progressive visual deficits caused by compression of the optic apparatus by a right elongated ACA documented on MR imaging. A 56-year-old man was referred to their neurosurgery department for binasal hemianopia that had progressed over the past 4 years. Cerebral MR imaging showed a right proximal ACA with a vascular loop that compressed the optic chiasm, especially on the right side, and displaced it inferiorly. No other cause could explain the progressive visual field deficits. The vascular loop was thought to be responsible for the progressive binasal deficit, and microsurgical decompression was recommended. Through a brow incision, a right supraorbital craniotomy was performed. The right A1 segment was larger than usual and tortuous, transmitting its pulsations into the chiasm. A piece of Teflon was inserted between the A1 segment and the chiasm, preventing the transmission of pulsations. After surgery, the visual field deficits improved progressively. At 4 months after surgery, the patient's visual fields were normal. In summary, microsurgical decompression of the elongated ACA as a cause of visual field deficit should be considered when facing a progressive and/or severe visual field deficit in the absence of any other apparent etiology. Decompression can be achieved through a minimally invasive supraorbital craniotomy.
The following case report is entitled Induction of Panic Attack by Stimulation of the Ventromedial Hypothalamus. It was written by W. Brian Willant and colleagues. Studies in rats and cats have shown that electrical stimulation of the ventromedial nucleus of the hypothalamus, the VMH, can induce panic attack-like behavior. This report on an awake patient undergoing surgery to have DBS electrodes implanted in the hypothalamus shows that stimulation of the VMH is effective in evoking panic attacks in a human. The attacks met the DSM-4 criteria for a panic attack, were reproducible, were reversible upon cessation of stimulation, and were evoked by stimulation from either hemisphere. Within 5 to 20 seconds of stimulation onset, a dramatic increase in anxiety was obvious, and the patient began to experience hyperventilation, shortness of breath, an increase in blood pressure, an increase in heart rate, and nausea. The patient also reported troubled feelings, saying, for example, "I'm getting very emotional." There are a number of small hypothalamic nuclei, but in this case, the stimulation was indeed directed at the VMH. Post-operative MR images showed the location of the implanted DBS macroelectrodes. The trajectories and depths were used to extrapolate the location of the more deeply inserted microelectrode used to evoke the panic attacks intraoperatively. On the left side, as the electrode progressed directly into the center of the VMH, the intensity of stimulation required to evoke an attack systematically decreased from 5 volts to 1 volt. On the right side, the electrode did not center in the VMH and instead progressed on the lateral aspect of the VMH. Consistent with a more peripheral activation of the nucleus, 4 volts or more was required to evoke a panic attack at each site. The results from the two hemispheres, taken together, show that the stimulation intensity required to evoke a panic attack increased as a function of the distance of the electrode from the center of the VMH.
Next, we have a technical note entitled Preoperative Evaluation of Neurovascular Relationships for Microvascular Decompression in the Cerebellopontine Angle in a Virtual Reality Environment. It was written by Zhou Ying Du and colleagues. Microvascular decompression procedure has been widely accepted as therapy of choice for neurovascular compression syndrome in the posterior fossa, such as trigeminal neuralgia and hemifacial spasm. In order to achieve surgical success, a precise knowledge of the neurovascular relationship is of first importance. In this article, the authors discuss their experience in simulating and visualizing the neurovascular relationship using the dextroscope, a virtual reality system. The system created a virtual reality environment in which 3D reconstruction of each anatomic structure could be performed based on a patient-specific 3D TOF MRA data and saved as an individual virtual object for further simulation using virtual tools provided by the system. Thus, the neurovascular relationships were observed and surgical trajectories were simulated. The results were visualized in a stereoscopic way that the 3D natures of structures could be well presented. Furthermore, each pre-surgically simulated result was compared to the intraoperative findings and proved to be highly concordant. The authors found that the VR environment was a powerful aid for spatial understanding of the neurovascular relationship in MVD for operating surgeons and trainees. It can create a highly concordant stereoscopic neurovascular model for MVD procedures, which effectively shortens the learning curve and adds to the surgeon's confidence.
Thank you for listening. To read all the articles published by the JNSPG this week, or to listen to more podcasts from the Journal of Neurosurgery or Neurosurgical Focus, please visit us at thejns.org.